So what do we discuss now, previous class?
India time.
Okay. He rang me this afternoon. He said he's going to India tonight. He'll be gone for 2 weeks. So he just said, please, I don't have time to. Actually, he has sent an email at 5 o'clock tonight to tell everyone that you won't get it until you go back. So he just said, please ask that everyone. So any points from our last class? What is that?
Because Krishna is unlimitedly powerful, he has inconceivable potencies because he is unlimitedly powerful, and therefore he can adjust all contradictions like birth, no birth, and these contradictions he can adjust. This inconceivable potency is called the Kriya Shakti of
Krishna. Any other points?
I had a very interesting point in one of the lectures today on Achintya Shakti. Conversation between Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Nityananda Prabhu, where Nityananda Prabhu apparently wants to go with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Puri, and then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, no, you stay here and then you don't come along with me to Puri.
To Puri?
Yeah.
Where are they?
Pardon?
Where are they? When
I think they were in Navadvipa or something like that, some other place. I don't remember the place exactly. But
oh, when he first took sannyas, maybe.
I don't know the full context, but only this example was given that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is telling Nityananda Prabhu that you can do preaching much better than me. So then they were explaining why it was said like that. That is because Nityananda Prabhu is more merciful. That's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wanted to project. He wanted to glorify Nityananda Prabhu by saying that you are more merciful. Through your mercy, even Jagai and Madai, you are compassionate to them. That way he was glorifying. But Nityananda Prabhu was glorifying Chaitanya Mahaprabhu back, that I am able to get any potency and mercy in my heart only because of your Achintya Shakti. Otherwise, where will I get it? So, like that, this conversation was so, Achintya Shakti was explained. We cannot do anything. Even our preaching will not have any potency if we don't have this Achintya Shakti coming from Mahaprabhu.
Any other points?
You're talking about the mixed rasas in the residence of Dwaraka as against the rasas in Vrindavan, how they are Aishwarya and Madhurya mixed. And so because it's mixed with Madhurya, they get distressed, even though they know that he is the supreme. So they still get, because this mixture of Madhurya and
rasas. Any other points?
Lord's eyebrow movement itself, the 650 million soldiers in Kurukshetra can be eliminated. So this is what is Aishwarya.
This is power. Any other points?
By studying all these pastimes, we are understanding, like by hearing about his pastimes, we are understanding his position as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it is very important to understand his position as being Supreme by studying the first 9 cantos. And then he said, you know, he makes us, we forget that he is Supreme by studying the pastimes in the 10th canto, and we see the dealings in the environment. So first 9 cantos are actually to make us realize that he is the Supreme, because if we directly meet the 10th canto, then he will take all those things very
cheaply. So these are some of the themes that are coming out so far in the third canto. The first chapter of the third canto is called Questions by Vidura. Like that. So Vidura takes the arrangement of Duryodhana speaking harsh words to him. He takes that as an arrangement of the Lord's internal potency, pastime potency, for him to leave and renounce his kingdom. Like that. So he leaves at that time. He's in a renounced temperament, as Prabhupada points out. A devotee is always in a renounced temperament. So whenever some misfortune comes upon a devotee, then the devotee understands this is Krishna's mercy upon me to bring me closer to him. So Vidura immediately leaves and he begins to travel around India to visit the different holy places. to purify his consciousness. He is feeling he is, although Krishna is still present on the planet personally, he feels that he is not qualified at that point in time because of his negative association with Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra, that he can directly approach Krishna. So then he feels that first I will go to all the holy places and I will perform sukriti or punya or pious activity in devotional service, bhakti sukriti, in order to purify my consciousness so then I can approach Krishna directly. So then in his travels he meets with Uddhava as he goes into central India and he comes onto the bank of the Jamuna. Then he meets Uddhava. And at that time, he begins to question Uddhava about Lord Krishna and Lord Krishna's associates. Even though he knows himself that Lord Krishna has left this planet, but still, he is feeling shocked and in disbelief. Prabhupada said psychologically he is feeling in disbelief. So he asks Uddhava, please explain to me about Lord Krishna passing away from this world. Please tell me about Lord Krishna and the Yadu dynasty. So then in the beginning of the second chapter, what is the second chapter called? The Remembrance of Lord Krishna. So then upon being asked to glorify Lord Krishna, then Uddhava goes into a trance, into samadhi. He meditates fully on Krishna. And in this state of consciousness, he becomes ecstatic. And he actually is absorbed in his consciousness in the spiritual reality of his eternal relationship with Krishna and Dwarka in the spiritual sky. But in order to preach to Vidura, then he brings his consciousness back down into this realm so that he can speak to Vidura, the Srimad Bhagavatam, like that. So then, he begins to describe Lord Krishna and Lord Krishna's greatness. And one of the main things he describes about Lord Krishna, if we look at the overview of the many things that he says, is that he is explaining Krishna's unlimited potency, that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this must be established for everyone. That Krishna stu Bhagavan Swayam. He is the unlimited, all-powerful, Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Uddhava is establishing this in many of the verses which he states. But then he explains to us that even though he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and even though Uddhava himself understands Krishna to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but still, the Bhagavatam is teaching us about rasa. Rasa means relationship between Krishna, the mellows exchange of relationship between Krishna and Krishna's devotees. And because the Srimad Bhagavatam is primarily about Krishna, then we see in Krishna's relationship with his devotees, we see that in all of Krishna's relationships with his devotees, the relationship is not based on pure awe and reverence. That is there more within Krishna's other expansions, such as Lord Narayan within Vaikuntha. The devotees are more in a mood of awe and reverence towards him. But with Krishna, it's never exactly like that. So whether Krishna is in Vrindavan Dham, or Mathura Dham, or Dwarka Dham, the devotees do not fully relate to him only as the supreme all-powerful entity. Rather, they relate to him in relationship with them. So, Uddhava himself and the members of the Yadu dynasty, as he explains, they have a mixed feeling of Madhurya and Aishwarya. That Krishna is the supreme all-powerful opulent personality, that is Aishwarya. But simultaneously, he is a member of our family. That is Madhurya, or sweetness. Like that. So they see him in both ways simultaneously. And then at the end of the chapter, as he was progressing, then he began to speak about Krishna's Vrindavan pastimes. And in Krishna's Vrindavan pastimes, the devotees in Vrindavan, because Uddhava was sent to Vrindavan by Krishna, so he has an appreciation of the level of realization and intimacy that is exchanged between Krishna and the Brijbasis in their eternal relationship with him. So he sees that in that relationship, it is simply madhurya. It is simply sweetness. There is no Aishwarya present. In other words, they do not relate to Krishna as a supreme or powerful being. There's no philosophical concept. The Dwarka Basis, Uddhava and the other devotees, they have this philosophical understanding that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. However, he is our family member. So although he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he is our family member, and they have feelings towards him in a relationship with their familial relationship. Whereas in Vrindavan, there is no conception that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is simply their son, or their friend, or their lover. That is how they feel. Right? There is no... In terms of rasa, Rupa Goswami explains, there is Shanta Ras, Dasya Ras, Sakya Ras, Vatsalya Ras, and Madhurya Ras. Okay? Everyone understands those five? Anyone needs it explained? You're on the phone, isn't it? Shanta means neutrality. You might have heard of these five people. Shanta means neutrality. Dasya means servitorship. Sakya means friendship. And then Vatsalya means parental mood, and Madhurya means the conjugal relationship. So in Vrindavan, there is only the higher three relationships. There is only Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya. There is no pure Dasya there. Dasya means servitorship, right? That he is supreme and we are the servants. That is what is in Vaikuntha, between the devotees of Vaikuntha and Lord Narayan. He is the Supreme Lord and we are the servants. And that is the mood which eternally exists there. But in Vrindavan, there is no pure Dasya. There's some Dasya, but it's mixed. But there's no pure Dasya. Everything is simply that Krishna is our most intimate friend, our most intimate child, or our most intimate lover. That is the mood which exists there. So therefore, Uddhava explains this at the end of the second chapter. And then in the beginning of the third chapter, which we'll explain tonight, what is the third chapter called?
Lord's
pastimes outside of Vrindavan. So now he explains the pastimes when Krishna leaves Vrindavan, and we'll have more understanding of this mixed relationship of the Aishwarya and the Madhurya, when Krishna is Mathura and then in Dwarka. And then we see the mixing of these two relationships. Oh, the mixing of these two concepts is there within this chapter, which we'll explain.
Is there
no
Dasya in Dwaraka and Mathura?
What's that?
Dasya Ras is not exhibited by anyone?
It's there. It's there. But... It will be there. Yeah, there will be Dasya. There will be servants. In Mathura and Dwarka, there will be servants like that. Even in Vrindavan, there's some Dasya. In other words, in Nanda Maharaja's palace, there are some servants. But because of Vrindavan pastimes, it's not pure servitorship. In other words, they will feel like Krishna is our son, if they are elder. Or they may have information of the conjugal pastimes, some of them messages and so forth. So therefore, there'll be some Madhurya like that. So it will not be pure Dasya. In Dwarka and Mathura, you may have more Dasya exhibited, but it may not be exactly, the mood may not be exactly like it is in Vaikuntha. In Vaikuntha, the mood of Dasya is extremely prevalent, whereas in Dwarka, it may be that we are the servant of this prince, but not that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead totally. They have that understanding, but there's also that he is this prince of Dwarka. So it's like a not as much awe and reverence as it would be in Vaikuntha. But yeah, there is some Dasya there. Any other points?
How do you understand the rasa of the other entities in Vrindavan, like the lakes and the trees? And how do you understand
the rasa? Yeah, so it seems like the Shanta is there. So for example, there is like blades of grass, or there are chintamani stones which are on the ground in Vrindavan. So each one of them is a pure devotee. So their position is somewhat shanta, which means neutral. Dasya means active. They don't go anywhere, they don't necessarily. So they're more like a shanta. But because they get trampled by the lotus feet of the gopis, then they have some appreciation of the Madhurya Ras. So they're not pure Shanta. Right? There's a mixing of the Madhurya Ras, for example. So that they may witness Krishna and the gopis' conjugal pastimes. like that. So therefore, their feeling is madhurya, like that. So it's not pure shanti.
But could that be the eternal position of some jivas?
What?
In a shantaras? Or,
yeah.
Or there is a migration from shantaras to...
No, some can be eternal like that. Like that. Just like, for example, if someone was like a blade of grass or one of the stones in Vaikuntha, then that could be pure shanta, like that. That would be the eternal position. Pure awe and reverence in a shanta relationship. But in Vrindavan, it's never pure shanta or pure dasya. Any other points?
So, Prabhu, which people, which type of devotees or yogis would get that position in Vrindavan of grass and Vrindavan?
That is an eternal position, like that. So, it depends on the jiva's constitutional nature. If that's where we've left from, then that's what we'll go back to, generally, like that. So, these are eternal situations. So, the devotees eternally have this form. Some devotees are eternally gopis, some devotees are eternally cowherd boys, some devotees are eternally like parents, elder members, like that. Some are eternally cows, some are eternally peacocks, some are eternally like blades of grass and like that. Does it make sense?
But someone like as we come closer to realizing our siddha deha, as we come, you know, our chanting becomes pure and we start it. So somebody would not be desiring, will somebody be desiring to become a blade of grass also, or because that is a determined position, we start desiring later?
No, because when your chanting becomes more pure, then that feeling of what you have towards Krishna, that original relationship, that begins to become unmanifest. It begins to manifest like that. So therefore those natural feelings will come. You'll feel more like I'm feeling like I'm attracted to Krishna as a cowherd boy. I am feeling I'm more attracted to Krishna as a gopi, like that. So this will come naturally as your chanting becomes very pure.
So even for grass it will come, I'm attracted to become the grass.
Yeah. It'll just be there. Because that's your, if that's your constitutional position, then that feeling will naturally come. But generally, you'll see the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, it's explained that they would generally have human-like forms, generally. So most of the positions will be human-like, means like gopis, gopas, like that. Not so much, you know, trees and cows, and not so much. Not that it's not there, but generally be human.
We can say one example, Sukadeva Goswami is a parrot, no? So we cannot say that Sukadeva Goswami is Shantara.
Yeah, he's not Shanta. He's
so
Madhurya.
So parrot means he's Madhurya. So even if you're a parrot or peacock or whatever, then...
Yeah, so Sukadeva Goswami is pure Madhurya. Yes. That's nice, isn't it?
I heard that the whole Vrindavan is like permeated with Madhurya. It's all in terms of Madhurya. So then...
Not entirely. No, there's two... See, there's two different meanings of the word Madhurya. Sometimes we say Madhurya means conjugal.
Mm-hmm.
But then we say, when we're talking in this context, we're saying a mixture between Aishwarya and Madhurya. So in that context, it means sweetness. So Vrindavan is only sweetness. But within Vrindavan, the higher three rasas, which are all Madhurya in the sense they're all sweet, like that. But it's not that there's only conjugal love. So the word Madhurya is sometimes used for both. Conjugal rasa can also be called Sringara rasa. But sometimes, most of the time, we call it Madhurya Ras. But Madhurya also means sweetness. Any other points?
Can you change the relationship?
Prabhupada said, you can, but generally it does not happen. It's not impossible, but generally it does not happen. It can happen like that, because Prabhupada said there's no limitation. But generally, Prabhupada said that generally the devotee is happy being whatever that devotee is. Is that okay?
Well, we are saying like the eternal positions of different entities, sometimes they are in the mode of like Shantiras or Dasiras or Sakshiras. So if they go to Golok Vrindavan where predominantly there is more of Dasiras, so then they will change their eternal position when they come to Golok Vrindavan?
No, because it means, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, I am in the heart of every living entity. I direct the wanderings of every living entity. right? So therefore, if someone has that Vaikuntha, like Swarup, or that eternal position in Vaikuntha, if he's come from Vaikuntha, and he's meant to go back to Vaikuntha, then Krishna will direct that he goes into the Sampradayas in South India, where Lakshmi and Narayan are very much worshipped. Right? But if someone has more that Goloka mood, then they will be directed towards the Gaudiya tradition. They'll become like followers of Mahaprabhu in general, and then they'll be directed towards that. Like that. So Krishna will direct you according to what your desire and nature is.
Is it not so that the eternal position of Goloka Vrindavan is superior to all the other things?
In some ways, yeah, superior. In some ways.
But Prabhu, what you said, the point we find here also, there are many devotees who are born in Ramananda Sampradaya, but they have taken to Brahmagaudiya Sampradaya and then started chanting, and then they are following Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. But equally, who have lived in this Brahmagaudiya Sampradaya for quite a number of years, maybe 7 years, 8 years, 10 years, but later on they felt that, well, they may not be, they are not able to appreciate what's happening here, and they moved, they went to Ramananda Sampradaya. So here itself we can see the example, as you said, Lord Krishna makes there.
Yeah, so the super soul and the heart is reciprocating. So it's up to you where you want to go. I know where I want to go. I want to go and live with Prabhupada and Tamal Krishna Raj. That's all I want to do. And I know where they are. So that's where we'll go. Wherever you want to go, that's where you'll go. So the Bhagavatam is teaching us about rasa. So rasa means the relationship. The mellow. Right? The nature of the relationships. So therefore, the Bhagavatam is revealing to us in these early part of this third canto, it is giving us a glimpse of what will take place in the tenth canto. In the tenth canto, these things will be very elaborately described. So in the third canto, there's like a preview of what will take place later on. So Uddhava is giving us a brief description of the rasa, or the relationships. And this rasa, or these relationships with Krishna, this swarup, is the goal of Krishna consciousness. It is satya, it is the perfection. To reach our eternal relationship with Krishna, to understand who we are eternally in relationship with Krishna. So these things are being identified in the beginning of this third canto. And very shortly, in a few chapters, then he will go back into creation and those kind of things like that. He will speak about the saga, the visarga, and then he'll go into the very technical aspects of these things. But he's telling us this is what you're aiming for, and then he'll go back to now how to get there. Like that. And then you have to go through the gradual process of how to get there. But the point is, there's an old saying in English, do not get on a ship if you do not know its destination. Right? Of course, it's fun to get on a ship when you don't know where it's going. That's very adventurous. But, actually speaking, you should not board a vehicle unless you know where it's going to. Like that. So, what Uddhava is revealing to us now, the Bhagavatam is revealing now, is the destination, or the goal. And then he'll go back and say, okay, now how to get to the goal. Like that. So that's what's been described. So tonight we'll go through half of the third chapter, verses 1 to 14. And then on next Saturday night we'll go through the remainder of the chapter. Lord's pastimes out of Vrindavan. Sri Uddhava said, thereafter, Lord Krishna went to Mathura city with Sri Baladev, and to please their parents, they dragged Kamsa, the leader of public enemies, down from his throne and killed him, pulling him along the ground with great strength. Pick up a bit.
King Kamsa's death is only briefly described here because such pastimes are vividly and elaborately described in the 10th canto. The Lord proved to be a worthy son of his parents even at the age of 16 years. Both brothers, Lord Krishna and Lord Baladeva, went to Mathura from Vrindavana and killed their maternal uncle who had given so much trouble to their parents, Vasudeva and Devaki. Kamsa was a great giant, and Vasudeva and Devaki never thought that Krishna and Balarama or Baladeva would be able to kill such a great and strong enemy. When the two brothers attacked Kamsa on the throne, their parents feared that now Kamsa would finally get the opportunity to kill their sons, whom they had hidden for so long in the house of Nanda Maharaja. The parents of the Lord, due to parental affection, felt extreme danger and they almost fainted. Just to convince them that they had actually killed Kamsa, Krishna and Baladeva pulled Kamsa's dead body along the ground to encourage them.
Mm. So what are some of the points here? Was it?
You say that
Vatsalya
Rasa? Say
it. Yeah. He's being displayed. Yeah. Any other points?
The Lord proved that he is a worthy son. Who can think of him?
Perfect son. Any other points? No, when he went to Mathura, he'd been on earth, because the Lord isn't any age. But in terms of how long he's been on earth, he'd been on earth 10 or 11 years. But he appeared at the age of 10 or 11, he appeared to be looking like a 16-year-old. So that's why it's being said, 16. Any other thoughts?
The power of Yogamaya is also mentioned here. In terms of covering Vasudeva and Devaki into thinking that they may not be able to kill
Kamsa.
There's also distress and anxiety even in true devotion. You know, they almost fainted.
Intense emotions. Anything else?
I think somewhere, not here mentioned, but I think somewhere it says that Kamsa was 12 feet in height, a giant person.
I would imagine, because Bhima was 12 foot tall. And Jarasandha and Kamsa would have been that kind of stature also. So we see here, this Bhagavatam is showing us the relationships between Krishna and Krishna's pure devotees. So the exchange of rasa is there. So all of Krishna's pastimes are meant to increase the rasa. Krishna has different names, such as Rasika Shekhar, Rasa Raj. Like that. So he has these different names, which means he is the instigator and the expander of rasa. So everything Krishna does in his pastimes is meant to increase the rasa or the pleasure in the relationship of the devotee. So the devotee is in Vatsalya Ras, as we see here with Devaki and Vasudeva. They're in Vatsalya Ras. So Krishna is acting in such a way at every moment to increase their feeling of paternal affection. In other words, to increase their love towards him as their son. So everything Krishna does in these relationships increases that feeling of rasa, of the stahi bhava, or the permanent ecstasy within the devotee. So it is said that when Krishna entered the wrestling arena of Kamsa, then there were 12 rasas, which Rupa Goswami explains in the Nectar of Devotion, in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So, 5 primary rasas and 7 secondary rasas. So it's said that when Krishna entered the wrestling arena in Mathura, then amongst all of the different personalities in that wrestling arena, then 10 of the 12 rasas were manifest, just as Krishna entered. Because everyone was seeing Krishna in a different way and feeling a different way towards Krishna. So the cowherd boys who were accompanying Krishna, they were feeling like Krishna is our friend. Nanda Maharaj was also there, Yashoda was there, and Devaki and Vasudeva were there, and they were also feeling that Vatsalya Rasa towards Krishna. There were great yogis who saw him as the Paramatma, as the Super Soul. Right? There were Brahmavadis, or Mayavadis, who just saw a white light going across the wrestling arena. So everyone was seeing, like the Matajis, the women within the arena, were seeing him as Cupid personified, as the most beautiful person, like that. Kamsa saw him as death, fear personified. He was just overcome with fear. So everyone who saw Krishna within the wrestling arena felt a different rasa or a different relationship with Krishna. And Krishna's purpose in all of his pastimes is to increase that rasa amongst his devotees. So he's perfect at doing this. He's perfect at bringing the rasa to the highest level in all of his pastimes. And that's why his name is Krishna, which means he's all attractive. Right? Everyone wants to be with Krishna. All the pure devotees want to be with Krishna constantly. Why? Because in his association, the pleasure of their feeling towards him is heightened and increased at every moment. So those who are Krishna's parents, as is being explained here, then that feeling of being the parent is heightened and increased at every moment in his relationship. And then paternal love for him, the Vatsalya Rasa, is just increased at every moment. So Krishna sometimes does apparently negative things to the devotees, creates apparently negative situations. Right? So in this instance, he enters in, him and Balaram have entered into the wrestling arena, and they're about to fight with Chanura and Mushti, the two wrestlers. Right? And everyone in the arena is just dismayed. How can these two teenage boys fight with these two huge wrestlers? Right? The people are just aghast, and people are actually crying out in the wrestling arena. They're just saying, "Stop, stop!" Right? How can you, King Kamsa? How can you, as the king, allow this to take place? Like that. So this is increasing the affection. And Vasudeva and Devaki are just feeling overwhelmed. They're just feeling that if Krishna fights with these personalities, he may die. Krishna and Balaram may die. So their affection is an attachment to Krishna. He's just being stimulated more and more and more. So in this verse it describes that Krishna kills Chanura and Mushti, right? They discard those bodies. I think Krishna jumps up into the arena, onto the dais where Kamsa is situated, and grabs him and throws him back down onto the arena, right? Back into the wrestling arena. And then he jumps down onto Kamsa and then he beats him to death in front of everyone in the arena, just pummels him. And kills him. And then Devaki and Vasudeva may still be apprehensive. So then he gets his body and he drags it around the arena just to show everyone, yeah, he's dead. No? And then he leaves his body there. But then afterwards he performs his funeral rites because he's his uncle. So afterwards he does his funeral rites, right? Because he's his uncle. Because Krishna is perfect in everything he does, like that. So then he does the right thing, like that. He didn't want to kill Kamsa, like that.
But Vasudeva and Devaki, were they not in the jail?
They must have been released at that time.
But still Kamsa was the king.
Yeah, but he must have brought them out of the jail to watch the wrestling match.
Was he sure today?
I think that was a mistake. Yeah, I think when I said that, that was a mistake. Nanda Maharaj had come. I don't think Yashoda was there. Okay, so read the next verse. These pastimes are very sweet. Okay. And if you stick around, one day we'll get to the 10th canto and we'll study them very deeply. In some future lifetime. The Lord learned all the Vedas with their different branches simply by hearing them once from his teacher Sandipani Muni, whom he rewarded by bringing back his dead son from the region of Jamaloka. Tiani, you like to read the purple?
Why am I so
old? Can't see? Then you read.
Somebody is speaking.
You can't see it?
Hmm?
You can see it.
No one but the Supreme Lord can become well versed in all the branches of Vedic wisdom simply by hearing once from his teacher. Nor can anyone bring a dead body back to life after the soul has already gone to the region of Yamarasa. But Lord Krishna ventured to the planet of Yamaloka and found the dead son of his teacher and brought him back to his father as a reward for the instructions given. The Lord is constitutionally well versed in the Vedas. From an authorized teacher and satisfied the teacher by service and reward, he himself adopted this system. The Lord offered his services to his teacher, Sandipani Muni, and the Muni, knowing the power of the Lord, asked something which was impossible to be done by anyone else. The teacher asked that his beloved son, who had died, be brought back to him, and the Lord fulfilled the request. The Lord is not therefore an ingrate to anyone who renders him some sort of service. The devotees of the Lord who always engage in his living service are never to be disappointed in the progressive march of devotional service.
Any points here?
Sandipani Muni knew that he could get what he wanted, and he asked the most impossible, because he knew who Krishna was to get that, and he is the only one who could do that.
The right person to ask.
And Krishna sets the example, as he says in the Gita. Yeah. So we all have the example for.
Yes.
Hearing once only Vedas, he could understand everything and learn everything. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, only you can do it.
Why could he understand everything by hearing it only one
because,
time?
Because he is Veda himself.
Because he invented it. So when he heard it the first time, then everything he heard, then automatically he understood.
He has shown example of those, everybody has to go for a teacher and an authorized teacher, and the executioner.
Yeah, very good. So in these pastimes, he says in the Gita, yad yad achara ki stri stas. Whatever example a great person says, everyone else will follow it. And he says himself that if I do not do it, right, then everyone else in the world will also make excuses. They'll say, well, I don't have to do it because Krishna did not do it. So Krishna shows the perfect example in his pastimes. So then with Sandipani Muni, who was his teacher, you two having a very important conversation there?
She can't understand.
What? Ask a question.
She couldn't understand what's written here because she can't see it that way. So
yeah.
I was explaining
okay.
What I
okay. So, Krishna sets the perfect example in every one of his pastimes. So you'll see there, as the student, in his pastime when he goes to Sandipani Muni's ashram, then at that time, he shows the perfect example of student life, of brahmacharya life. He has a very short brahmacharya period as a brahmacharya. 64 days, he learns the 64 arts and sciences. So he studies under Sandipani Muni, and because he's a perfect student, then he only has to be taught something once, and immediately it is imbibed and fully understood and realized and perfected by the Lord. Wouldn't it be nice if every student was like that? Right? How good would the teacher feel? Right? If every student was that perfect like that. But we're all conditioned souls. We don't have that kind of nature like the Lord has. But he's the perfect student. And he shows the example that we must accept a guru. Right? This must be accepted by every person. This is his teaching like that. The Lord himself accepts a guru. Why does the Lord need to accept a guru? Right? He is the Adi Guru. He is the original teacher. He spoke the Bhagavad Gita. Right? Every other guru who comes in disciplic succession is simply teaching and repeating the Lord's own teachings within the Bhagavad Gita. Right? So he does not need to accept a guru. But for our example, to show how important it is, then he accepts a guru. Right? So that is his mercy that he shows like that. And then the principle of education is that one must offer dakshina to the teacher in order for the reciprocation between student and disciple, between student and teacher, or disciple and guru, to be perfect. There must be dakshina involved. So it means that the student must offer something to the teacher in return for the education. Just like when you take initiation from your guru. Now, if we take initiation in ISKCON, and we take our vow to chant 16 rounds a day and follow the four regulative principles. We take that vow, then we must offer dakshina. Right? Otherwise the jagya is not complete on our behalf. Right there. So therefore something must be offered. And generally we offer money in this day and age. But you can offer anything. I remember when Prabhupada, I think when Prabhupada was just up there and he initiated some devotees, then some devotees would bring him fruits. And they were bringing different things. You know, this is all traditional, this is correct, like that. But generally, these days, you know, being Kali Yuga, we offer money. That's what everything is these days, basically. Everything else is not worth as much like that. But the point is that the gift must be offered. But Krishna, being the supreme personality, then he offers the ultimate gift to the guru. And he says to the guru, then please tell me, what can I give you in return for everything you've given me? And he says that I want my dead son back. Okay, so Krishna says, yes, I will do this for you. And then Krishna goes to the abode of Yamaraj, and he returns the dead son. Actually, I think in the 10th canon, does he go to Varuna's abode?
Goes to
Yamaraj?
Sends him to the ocean.
Sees Yamaraj first, then goes. So only Krishna can do this. They can return the soul back to the teacher like that. So in every way he's shown perfection in all of his pastimes. So whenever people criticize Krishna for being immoral and so forth in Vrindavan, when he leaves Vrindavan he acts perfectly. And he follows Dharma perfectly. When he's in Vrindavan he may do things which are somewhat contradictory. But that's why people have to understand his position, because there's nothing defective in him. Everything he does is perfect. Right? If he's dancing with the gopis, that is perfect. Right? Because that is his desire. He is supreme. He is sanctioned to do it. Right? So if someone finds discrepancy within him from a materialistic point of view, they say, oh, he's not perfect, he's doing irreligious activity. No, he's not imperfect, because he is the supreme personality. And therefore everything he is doing is perfection. Right? And that relationship between the gopis, as was mentioned in the last verse of the previous chapter, that relationship is based on experience in the highest rasa within creation, between his most exalted devotees. Right? There's nothing imperfect, because the gopis have no other love but for Krishna. And the fact that there's an apparent, and they're apparently married to someone else, it's just to increase the nectar of the pastimes. That's all. There's no actual marriage there. There's no actual contact there. It's just all lila. Like that. Even in the spiritual world, it says the gopis don't have husbands. Manifest. They're not there. Only when they come here in this world, then you actually see there's husbands, and you see Abhimanyu and the husbands in the pastimes. But in the spiritual world, they're not actually there. There's just a feeling that they're there. So it makes the parakeet above take place, but actually there's no husband. So there's nothing in Krishna's pastimes which is defective.
When Krishna learned all the 64 acts in 64 days, so is the same with Balaram as well?
Yeah. He's pretty smart as well. He's an intelligent guy. Because Balaram is in Gauranga Lila, he is Nityananda. And Nityananda is the Adi Guru, he's the original Guru. So yeah, no problem for him.
I'm not able to recall Maharaj's name, but Maharaj in one of his lectures, he said that Lord Krishna, when Lord Brahma hides the gopas for that 1 year period, actually it is Lord Krishna who expands into gopas. And then that's how the rasa between the parents and the gopas takes place. And during that period, that the gopas get married to the gopis. So actually, there's no contradiction. Though Lord Krishna is having Rasalila, he's actually having Rasalila with his own wife. That's how Maharaj reconciles.
Yeah, that's there. There's actually many ways that Krishna reconciles. But the point, people don't even read all these things. They don't even know all these things. They just criticize it. If someone criticizes him, then sometimes I say to people, have you read the Srimad Bhagavatam? Mm. If I'm preaching to someone, they say, oh, Krishna is this, Krishna is that. I said, have you read the Srimad Bhagavatam? Have you read all 18,000 verses? I said, then don't talk to me. Right? Until you go and read all 18,000 verses, then you cannot say. First, you study Krishna deeply. You study him. And when you understand him, then you come and talk to me. But don't just say, oh, Krishna did this, Krishna did that. What is your knowledge? What is your understanding? That's one thing you can say.
A side comment, Prabhu. It is said that Narayan Narayana, that is, Narayan is Lord Krishna and Narayan is Arjuna, they give Guru Dakshina the same day to their respective teachers.
Nice.
So I have a basic question. When we say Lord has 64 qualities, then we are talking about Lord Krishna, but what about Balaram? How do you understand? You understand 60 qualities or
64.
Ramana.
Only Balaram. Only Balaram. No other incarnation. Only Balaram. Everyone else 60. Krishna has four which they don't have. Rupa Madhurya, Lila Madhurya, Prema Madhurya, Vena Madhurya. Only those four. No one else has, only Krishna. Even in Dwarka Krishna will not have those four. Right? Only Krishna in Vrindavan has those four, and Balaram.
Including Venu Madhurya.
Yeah, he plays the flute very well. And he has his own gopis. Like that. He has his own rasa lila. Actually, there's some pastimes where they come together and they dance together. You see the pastime of Shankachuda, the demon who came and stole the gopis. That's at Govardhan Hill. Right? That place is at Govardhan Hill where that pastime took place. Then Krishna and Balaram are dancing together, and Krishna's gopis came and Balaram's gopis came. Balaram has his gopis, Krishna has his gopis. There's no mix. Radharani and Balaram, no contact, anything like that. It's different rasa. So here's his gopis, and sometimes they come together and they have rasa lila together. Then Shankachuda, that demon, came and he started to take the gopis away. And Krishna and Balaram chased him, and then Krishna got him and killed him.
One quick question, bro. Where is this region of Yamaloka in our planetary system?
It is Pluto. What they call Pluto, that is Yamaloka. That'll be in the fifth canto.
Well, it says that when it is difficult to see Krishna, it is to unform. It says in 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita that even demigods, they cannot see him to unform, and that only Ananya devotees, Ananya bhaktas, they can see his to unform. How Shankachuda could even be present on the residence?
Then if Krishna allows like that. If Krishna allows the demons then to Vrindavan, they can enter Vrindavan. It's just for some lila, some pastime. Okay. It says in the spiritual world, in Goloka Vrindavan, the demons are not actually there. Just sometimes everyone will say, Arishtasura is coming. So then everyone feels frightened. And then they all run to Krishna. Like that. So it increases the pastime. But in the material pastimes, the material world, then Krishna has to have husbands for the gopis, and he has to have demons manifest, otherwise it won't make sense. So he allows the demons to enter just for his pastimes to take place. Like that. Does that answer what you're saying?
I think Ramaswamy also mentioned that demons
could
see Krishna
rather than
see someone else. I don't
understand
the demons.
It was either that or it was the other way. Maybe I don't think they could see the gopis. If you read the commentary in the 10th canon. Yeah, I think they couldn't see the gopis because they still have material lust. Because the gopis have spiritual bodies. So they could just see Krishnas.
Okay.
Many Krishnas dancing. I think that's how it was described. Somebody have a point?
How would you say the relationship between a teacher and a student? Would it be vatsalyaras too?
Yeah.
Or some evening?
Yeah, that's the feeling. How does the teacher feel towards the student? How does the guru feel towards the disciple? How does the parent feel towards the child? Same. Feelings the same. Vatsalya rasa. Feelings the same.
Can I ask you something? Why there is no brother-sister relationship? Subhadra is sister, no? So that Sakya only? Sakya?
Some Sakya. Like with Balaram. Balaram is some Sakya. His friend is there, but it's also some Vatsalya because he's the older brother. So some Vatsalya is there too. And there's some Dasya because he does the services for Krishna. So, you know, the rasas are like mixed. But the principal rasa is the Sakya. Principal rasa.
So, no brother, sister, separate rasa? Only brother relationship?
So, like some brother and sister means some Sakya. Because brothers and sisters feel like friends. Equality. But if it's younger, then you feel like dasya. Some dasya because this is the older one. And if it's some younger one, then you feel that's vatsalya because that's.
And one more, nobody feels like they are Krishna's daughter or Krishna's son.
Yeah, yeah, in Dwarka.
Not in
Vrindavan, no. But in Dwarka, Krishna has.
Anirudhana.
It says here, he has 10 sons, and he has 16,108 wives. and 10 sons.
From each.
From each. How much is that one?
161,080.
Like that. That's a lot of kids. That's a lot of kids. What I'm going to do, I'm going to keep going. Because we're going to cover some more verses.
You can ask one last question. No.
Nice try, Shekhar. I'll keep going, and then maybe you can ask the questions as the class goes. Like that, because we have to cover some more verses. Otherwise, there's been another 5 questions, so we won't have time. Unless you want to do 2 verses tonight.
In the next sloka, we'll ask the question, and then get the US question.
Yeah, you can do like that. Just save the time. Attracted by the beauty and fortune of Rukmini, the daughter of King Bhishmaka, many great princes and kings assembled to marry her. But Lord Krishna, stepping over the other hopeful candidates, carried her away as his own share, as Garuda carried away nectar. This was one of the systems of marriage. Yeah. This system of marriage can only be followed by the Kshatriyas. It can't be followed by the other Varnas. By the other Varnas, it's not considered honourable to just go and steal a woman. Just go and take it and go like that. But the Kshatriyas can do it, and it's considered honourable because it shows their chivalry and their power like that. So Krishna would just do this. All the Kshatriyas would do it. But Krishna did it. And when he stole Rukmini, he was driving away in the chariot, and then Shishupal and all the other princes, very powerful warriors, they began to follow Krishna. And then Balaram came along. Oh, actually, Krishna fought with him, first of all. He gave Rukmini the reins. He gave Rukmini the reins because he's driving the chariot. And he gave Rukmini the reins. He said, "You drive, and I'll fight." So off the back of the chariot, Krishna was fighting with all the warriors, thousands of warriors. Krishna was fighting with them. And then Balaram came along with Krishna's army. And Balaram said, "You just go. I'll take care." So Krishna just rode off into the sunset with Rukmini.
But didn't Balaram want Rukmini to marry
Subhadra? Subhadra. And I think there's a disagreement over another marriage too. Yeah, but that particular marriage, yeah. Subhadra. Balaram wanted to marry to Duryodhana, and Krishna wanted to marry to Arjuna. So then Krishna arranged that Arjuna came dressed as a sannyasi. And then he stole Subhadra. And Balaram was going to kill him. He was going to kill Arjuna. Because he said, "What's this? He comes into my house as a sannyasi. And he steals my sister." He said, "I'll kill him." And Krishna fell at his feet. He said, "Don't kill him." He said, "This is my desire that ends in spirit."
So what is this... the first time Garuda carried away nectar.
Garuda stealing the nectar? Anyone know? When Garuda stole the nectar? Anyone knows that part?
Churning the ocean.
Churning the ocean.
In the churning of the ocean.
No, that is the demon. That is the
Mohini. There would be some pastime there. I don't know which pastime, but there would be some pastime where Garuda would have stolen the nectar.
Tree with
Krishna.
His
mother was the slave of the snakes, so to save her, the snakes, she was the sold to save her. The snakes, to free her from slavery, they asked him to give the nectar.
Oh.
So he went and got the nectar, and somehow the exchange came before he gave the nectar, and he took back the nectar. I don't know what happened exactly. And a little bit of nectar fell on the kusha grass, and the snakes wanted the nectar, and they slit their tongues. That's why the snakes, they have slit tongues.
Mm. It's from one of the Puranas.
Yeah,
there's a story there. I don't know the story.
Can I make a small comment? Because it's Rukmini Mataji and Subhadra. They drive the chariots to indicate the society that it is out of their willingness that Lord Krishna took away Rukmini, and also Arjuna took Mother Subhadra. So it's just to tell everyone, so this is that you drive the chariot, because it's not that we are forcing you to come, but out of your willingness that we are taking it.
Yeah, it's a good point.
So
all these pastimes of Rukmini being stolen is all only in this material world, no? In this spiritual world, in Dwarka, these pastimes are not, they are eternally husband. I would imagine, yeah. I would say it's only in the earthly pastimes. By subduing seven bulls whose noses were not pierced, the Lord achieved the hand of Princess Nagnajiti in the open competition to select her bridegroom. Although the Lord was victorious, his competitors asked the hand of the princess, and thus there was a fight. Well equipped with weapons, the Lord killed or wounded all of them, but he was not hurt himself. Just to please his dear wife, the Lord brought back the Parijata tree from heaven, just as an ordinary husband would do. But Indra, the king of heaven, induced by his wives, henpecked as he was, ran after the Lord with full force to fight him. So Prabhupada points out the purport. There's no defect in Krishna once again, because he's the supreme proprietor. So if Krishna desires to take a Parijata tree, then there's no defect on his behalf, because he is the creator of the Parijata tree. So he's taking that. But Indra was put under pressure. And Prabhupada says in the purport, it's funny the way Prabhupada writes it. Indra's wives inspired him to run after the Lord to fight. And Indra, because he was a henpecked husband and also a fool, listened to them and dared to fight with Krishna. Like that. So, Prabhupada draws the distinction between Indra and between Krishna. Krishna is simply reciprocating the love of his pure devotee. Like that. So Krishna is henpecked also. Right? Prabhupada points this out in the Krishna book. Krishna is also henpecked. Like that. Satyabhama gives him a very hard time. He's henpecked. Right? But the difference is she's a pure devotee. And he is the Supreme Lord. So these pastimes are on the eternal spiritual platform. And Indra is... Indra is a material person. And he's interfering with the Lord's pastimes. You know, if God himself comes, you know, into the courtyard and takes one of the gardenias, you know, Aniruddha Prabhu doesn't run out with a shovel. You know, come back. You know. Like that, you know, Chintaroopa saying, go and get it. They don't listen to me. So this would not happen, right? Because it's the Lord, right? If Balaba jumps off the altar, right, and takes one of the flowers for Radharani, yeah, we don't run around and say, hey, we say, oh, that's great. If Balaba, you know, actually it was our fault that we didn't pick it and offer it to him. So Indra was in material consciousness, and because he was in material consciousness, then Krishna chastised him like that. So even though his Indra is very powerful, but in front of Krishna he was chastised. Smashed. Narakasura, the son of Daritri, the earth, tried to grasp the whole sky, and for this he was killed by the Lord in a fight. His mother then prayed to the Lord. This led to the return of the kingdom of the son of Narakasura, and thus the Lord entered the house of the demon. There in the house of the demon, all the princesses kidnapped by Narakasura at once became alert upon seeing the Lord, the friend of the distressed. They looked upon him with eagerness, joy, and shyness, and offered to be his wives. So the princesses, they could not ask anyone else to be their husband. In the Vedic culture, the woman was always in association with the father, right? She never left the protection of her father in the Vedic culture, like that. So then it was sure that the girl was pure. Right? She had not been contaminated or adulterated because she was protected by the father. And then the father would give her to the husband. Right? And then it was sure that she was a pure girl, right? And then he was also a cultured boy. And then everything would be proper within the family. But when the princesses were stolen by the demon, then, because they were taken away from the father's home, no one would accept them now. No one would marry them now. It's not possible for them to become married. So therefore, they said to Krishna, please you marry us. And because Krishna understood they were his, actually they were his eternal consorts. They were his eternal pure devotees. Because they had pure love for Krishna. And Krishna accepted them, even though others would not even touch them. Other chacharis would not accept them. They would say, you have been touched by another person. You have left your father's home. We will not touch you. So they had no shelter. So Krishna, this shows Krishna's reciprocation with his devotees. Even when the devotee may be in a materially low position or considered to be materially outcast from material society, but if they have pure love for Krishna, then Krishna will accept them. Right? And there's many examples in the Shastras of these things taking place. So Krishna only sees the pure devotion. He does not see the material, the bodily content, like that, or the material, what appears to be discrepancies. Right? Krishna does not take those things into account. He only sees the love of his devotees. Right? He doesn't see the material side. So we should also learn to see like that.
The very culture point which you brought up, we can see similarly when Bhishma Dev picks up those three sisters, Amba, Ambalika, and so one of the sisters, she says that she is not willing to marry names I'm not able to remember, but she refused to marry. Bhishma Dev tries to hand over back the girl to her father. He says no, and she tries to approach as a lover. Lover says no, you're contaminated, you can't be taken. Therefore, she commits suicide.
No, he doesn't say that she's contaminated. He says that I have won you in the battle. I have lost with Bhishma. I have lost you in the battle, so I cannot take you back.
He says that, and also because Bhishma took her hand, he took her hand and put her on the chariot. So the girl, in Vedic culture, the girl was never touched by a boy while she lived in the father's home. She was never touched by a boy, so it was known that she was pure. So therefore, when she was taken by the hand of Bhishma, he said, now I will not touch you. You've been touched. You go and marry him. She goes back she goes back and says, now can I marry you? And he said, well, I'm a brahmachari, I can't marry you. Like that. So she said, okay, then I will kill you. So she does austerities. She becomes Shikhandi in the next life. And then Shikhandi is born as a girl and turns into a boy halfway through. And then fights Bhishma. And then Bhishma won't fight him on the battlefield because he says, you're a woman, so I won't fight you.
Not that so. And only Bhishma Dev can recognize that he is the not the best.
Yeah, like that. And the pastimes go on and on, as Mahabharata does. But we want to take rest before 10:30 tonight. Otherwise, when you get into the Mahabharata, you may never come out again. So. You're a lot of the body there.
So okay. Narakasura the son of Lord
Vishnu. What is the question?
Narakasura.
Say it again.
He was the son of Lord himself.
It says that, yeah.
Yes.
In the purple. Yeah. But Prabhupada points out in the purple that the son became demoniac by association. So you can kill the relative if they become demoniac by association. So you'll see in Kurukshetra, that's what the whole Kurukshetra war is based upon. The family members become demoniac. So Arjuna says in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, I don't want to kill them because they're family. And then Krishna preaches and says, actually they're demons. So it is your duty to kill them at this point in time. So if the son or the father or anyone becomes demoniac, then it's not sinful to kill.
Why doesn't he just stop them from becoming demoniac?
Because then it would take out the free choice of the living entity. Because then the living entity doesn't have free choice, and if he doesn't have free will, then it's not.
That's it.
Yeah, that's the nature of the living entity. It's built with free will. Just as Krishna has free will, then everyone else has free will as well. So Krishna can't, he can, but he won't interfere with free will.
We don't give them the option to tidy up their acts and annihilate
someone. No, that's actually, it's more merciful, because what takes place at the time of death, no one likes to die. So if someone kills you, then generally what you remember, you'll see in the Bhagavatam, like when the demons are killed, you'll see that like at the time of death, they realize, you know, I made a big mistake here. You know, I wasted my life when I should have actually been devotionally inclined. And I've been inimical to the Lord. So, you know, my consciousness has been totally wrong. That's why we kill people like that. That's why in our philosophy there's corporal punishment. That's the whole purpose. If someone's murdered someone, then you kill them. So immediately within their subtle body, which goes into their next birth, then they've understood, I've done a wrong thing. It's very shocking upon the subtle body to be killed like that. So that is our position.
So we hear, it is said that Narakasura had a boon that he would be killed only by his mother, and therefore Satyabhama kills because she is his mother.
And I'm going to go to the next verse. Because this one will go, you know, all night. All those princesses were lodged in different apartments, and the Lord simultaneously assumed different bodily expansions, exactly matching each and every princess. He accepted their hands in perfect rituals by his internal potency. This one pastime alone proves that Krishna is Bhagavan. No one else can marry 16,108 wives. No one else can expand into 16,108 forms simultaneously and live with those wives in a palace which is 4 square miles in diameter.
Okay. Our Guru Maharaj said that he does everything with his time.
With what?
Our Guru Maharaj says that Lord Krishna does everything with his time.
With style. Yeah. Everything with style. If you're going to get married, then marry 16,108. And then Prabhupada says, why 16,108? Why not 16 million? Nothing for Krishna. Nothing. No problem. This proves his supremacy.
He's Paramatma anyway.
Paramatma is just his expansion. Like that. Krishna himself is unlimited. He's so powerful. So this pastime shows his supremacy. Right? He's supreme. No one can match this. No one can match this. Supreme entity like that. So this is what the Bhagavatam is teaching. This is who this supreme entity is.
Actually, I mean, like, here we have the designation of man, woman, and all. But actually, it's just we are all female, and he's the only Purusha. That he is the angel.
Factually speaking, yeah. Yeah, it's true. Philosophically, that's true.
The good thing.
Okay. Just to expand himself according to his transcendental features, the Lord begot in each and every one of them 10 offspring with exactly his own qualities. Just to continue the point. You know, not enough that he marries that many wives, then has 10 children by each, right? And maintains each one. I'll keep moving because we're just going. If you have questions, ask me in the next class, because we're just, the hands keep going up, but we can't. Kali Yavana, the king of Magadha, that means Jarasandha, and Shalva attacked the city of Mathura. But when the city was encircled by their soldiers, the Lord refrained from killing them personally, just to show the power of his own men. Of kings like Shambhara, Dvivida, Bana, Mura, Balval, and many other demons such as Dantavakra. Sometimes he killed himself and some he caused to be killed by others, Sri Baladev, etc. Then, O Vidura, the Lord caused all the kings, both the enemies and those on the side of your fighting nephews, to be killed in that battle of Kurukshetra. All those kings were so great and strong that the earth seemed to shake as they traversed the war field. Duryodhana's bereft of his fortune and duration of life because of the intricacy of ill advice given by Karna, Dushasan, and Sobal. When he lay on the ground with his followers, his thighs broken, although he was powerful, the Lord was not happy to see the scene. So this proves the point, and this is connected to that question you just also asked, Tiani, that this is the Lord's position. He does not like to see the living entities inimical towards him, because every living entity originally is his devotee. Right? Krishna doesn't create living entities in the beginning to be demons. There's like sometimes in what they call Christianity these days, or churchianity, they have these misconceptions. And some of the misconceptions are that, you know, the Lord created all the souls and we all took birth here in different situations. And some of us are demons and some of us are pious. And then at the end of your life, if you just say, you know, Jesus loves you, then you go back to Godhead forever. You know, totally illogical, like that. So the correct understanding of the origin of the jiva is that the jiva is eternal. And the jiva originally was a devotee. Right? All jivas originally are devotees. No such thing as, you know, God creating demons. But because they misuse the independence, then they take birth in the material world.
But Prabhupada says that if you chant Hare Krishna properly once, that you can go and come back to Godhead.
Yeah, but that what that properly means, that's a very exalted properly.
The moment of death, if you chant Hare Krishna,
you can go. But how can you
try? Yeah, but he didn't go straight back to Godhead. He went to, took birth in Hardwar, I think, and he had to perfect his devotional service. He did go back to Godhead, but not like straight back. Yeah, you can. Well, Prabhupada says it's correct. Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you. No, I'm not disagreeing.
The question I think was asked, you know, does one have to be initiated to be a devotee? And Prabhupada said no, that you can, if you chant Hare Krishna.
Yeah, that's true.
You can go back home, back to Godhead, which is similar to what the Catholics are saying.
It's similar, but it's also different because within Prabhupada's statement, there's, you know, deeper things implied. Mm-hmm. It's not just any chanting.
Oh, of course not. Yeah. You said it has to be chant purely.
That's the point. Chant purely. And that kind of chanting is not easy. That's not easy. You'll have to chant thousands of rounds to get that one round that'll take you back to Godhead. That's even with Ajamila, he didn't go straight back to Godhead. Mm. Right? He had to perfect his devotional service in the next life, and then he went back. But the power of the Holy Name delivered him from all the sins that he'd committed. That's the point.
Where is that first temple?
Which one?
Of the Adam.
Canto 6.
So he had to come back again.
Yeah, he took birth again. And perfected his devotional service. So the point is that Krishna, even with Duryodhana, when he saw Duryodhana was inimical towards him, hey, Lilamai? So when he saw that Duryodhana was inimical towards him, this pains the Lord. He doesn't like to see his sons, his children, who are naturally his devotees, he doesn't like to see them in an inimical state of consciousness. So therefore the Lord may chastise them, right? But that is in order to rectify their consciousness. So that they will, in their next life, understand more deeply that they must surrender to him and go back to the spiritual world. Okay, the last verse for tonight. After the end of the battle of Kurukshetra, the Lord said, "The abatement of the earth's great burden, 18 Akshahinis, has now been effected with the help of Drona, Bhishma, Arjuna and Bhima. But what is this? There is still the great strength of the Yadu dynasty, born of myself, which may be a more unbearable burden." So this sometimes is said that you read in the Bhagavatam that the Yadu dynasty was an unbearable burden for the earth. Right? So this means, as the Acharyas explain, if you read the purport, then Prabhupada explains, Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explain, that burden means the burden that the earth will feel when they disappear. Because the earth is actually in ecstasy when there's a pure devotee or the Lord himself, or hundreds of thousands of pure devotees, in the sense of the Yadu dynasty, hundreds of thousands, even millions of the Lord's pure devotee associates who are on the earth, the Lord is in ecstasy to have them on the earth. And the earth feels completely, Bhumi Devi feels completely distraught when there are demons all over her surface. That's why she went to Brahma in the beginning of the 10th canto to pray like that. So the burden that she is feeling is that she'll be separated from them when they leave. So he's thinking, how is it that I'm going to, because it's inevitable they must leave, how will I arrange that they leave? And then she will feel that burden, and is also inevitable, because these pastimes must finish, these worldly pastimes. Prabhupada makes the subsidiary point within the purports. He says that there is no such thing as overpopulation of the earth. You know, we have this population thing, you know, they're like, there's 6 billion people on earth now. They're saying, I think now they're saying by 2020, I think it is, there'll be 9 billion. They'll think that's what they're saying. It might be 2050, but I think it's 2020. They'll say there'll be 9 billion. So they're all saying, how will we feed everyone and everything? Prabhupada said there could be 6 times the present earth's population. 6 times. That's
36 billion.
People. And Prabhupada said there's no problem. Because who is the father? Right? And Krishna can easily supply for everyone. Right? But there has to be one rule. Dharma has to be followed. Right? In other words, people have to be following piety. And they have to be surrendered to Krishna, which is the supreme Dharma. Right? But when there's adharma on the planet, we see now we only have 6 billion. Right? Because there's adharma, there's famine, there's poverty, all these problems in there. And it's only because of adharma. Right? There's insufficient rainfall at this point in time, there's floods, whatever. It's all because of adharma. But when these things are followed properly, when devotional service is followed properly, then automatically Prabhupada says you can have unlimited people. Not unlimited, but yeah, the point is that. Okay, we'll stop there because I think that's true. Srila Prabhupada Ki.